For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Legislative leaders release a $6.8 billion budget. Competing bills from the House and Senate were given to lawmakers just 45 minutes before midnight on Tuesday. They appear to give about 5% cuts to most state agencies, while mostly holding harmless core services like common education, transportation, corrections, and healthcare. Neva, what are your thoughts on this budget?
Well, I think your analysis is pretty spot on in terms of what happened and what the crux of the budget is. I think bottom line, the lawmakers have figured out a way to come up with a budget that they can get the votes and live with, and that was their mission this week if they were going to avoid special sessions. So I think the fact that they did hold the core services harmless, that even though there are cuts, they're certainly far below what agencies were told at the start of the session they needed to look at, as high as 15%. So I think the fact that in a very bad budget year they've been able to come up with what they have, the takeaway is that everyone talks about almost before the ink dries that what is looked at for the next session. But I think there's some things we can talk about on the next session that make it maybe not as bleak as what they came into this year.
Ryan.
I think it's a miserable failure at almost every level. I mean, this is a budget that's put together with scotch tape and spit, and it's going to come undone this session or this summer. You know, they at the end, Republican leadership, who control near supermajorities in both chambers. I mean, there are 26 Democrats out of a 101-member House, 26 Democrats, and yet they want to blame it on the Democrats for not coming to the table so that they could pass actual revenue-raising measures which require a supermajority vote in the House of Representatives and the legislature in general. And so now we've seen things like we're going to call the cigarette tax a fee. We're going to call a sales tax on cars an increase. We're going to remove a rebate on an incentive, and it's not a revenue-raising measure, so we don't need the three-quarters vote. All of these little sleight of hands are exactly that. I mean, they're looking at revenue-raising measures and saying, well, it's not a revenue-raising measure because we say it isn't. Now, we saw last week, we talked about the Supreme Court looking at, you know, whether a bill is a revenue-raising measure or not, and they seem to give some deference, although slight, to the legislature in determining what that is. This is not even close. I mean, we've been talking about these exact same things as revenue-raising measures for the last 4 or 5 weeks now and these budget negotiations to say at the very end that they're not, just so that they can get through this vote and get out of here without a special session, is frankly irresponsible. Because, I mean, I think that anybody who's got a head on their shoulders in that building knows that these are going to be challenged. And if we're still hundreds of, and even with these revenue-raising measures, we're still hundreds of millions short. We're going to come back this summer and fall. If you get those kicked out in court, we're right back into a special session.
And even is there concern that these bills might not be constitutional, what that's going to mean for
I mean, I think there's certainly speculation and concern. I think the chief concern probably is on the cigarette tax. That one seems to be the one that is fee tax. Whether that's going to pass constitutional muster, I think, is the big question. Now, excise tax, the gross production tax, the extended lateral drilling, all of those things that were the hard issues and hard votes that the Republicans came up with votes on at the end, I think there is a strong likelihood that they will prevail. So I think the interesting thing about the whole dynamic in the legislature with Republicans and Democrats, particularly in the House, it seemed to me that the House Democrats, in their quest to become very greedy at the end and their holdout for what they wanted, they lost traction. And really, I think we saw with the minority leader, Scott Inman, I mean, his ability as he came back to the table and said that he couldn't get votes from his caucus on, you know, virtually anything at the end, I think that pointed to the fact that there were opportunities there for some real negotiation and compromise on some of those areas that they may have given up some ground, and I'm not sure they gain politically politically in the rhetoric that they seem to say and suggest that they're going to have in the next campaign cycle.
I mean, right. Well, the greed, I think, exists in any of his comment, but I think it's misplaced. It's not on the House Democrats here. It really belongs on the oil and gas industry. You know, we've talked about paid protesters in here. Harold Hamm and other folks bust their employees, and I'm going to bet that they didn't have to take paid time off, or they didn't have to take time off without pay. I'm sure they're probably paid protesters going to the Capitol, trying to save jobs that aren't going anywhere. The oil and gas is in the ground, and here in Oklahoma, it's not going to be exported. And when we talk about greed, what we saw was a total and complete capitulation to the oil and gas community and saying that they don't want to pay their fair share. Going to 5% is the compromise. It's lower than the historic rate of 7%. You know, what the House has done by moving some wells up to a 4%, that may seem like they're doing something, but the actual revenue there is much smaller because it only deals with wells that were begun drilling in 2015 or between 2011 and 2015. That's going to expire. So the amount of money that's actually being raised is very little, and it looks like they've done something, but they've really held their friends in the oil and gas industry harmless.
Well, I mean, the numbers that were put out, I mean, and the Tax Commission was very conservative in their estimates on what that would be. The $19 million was based on, frankly, the volatility, the fluctuation in oil and gas prices. But if you look at industry analysts, and let's discount the fact that, yes, they are industry analysts, but their numbers push as high as $90+ million. So I think, I mean, you're talking about a major industry in the state who clearly, when you look at the numbers, I mean, it's not that they're getting some deal that's the best deal around. I think everyone came to the session knowing that there were going to that everyone was going to have to fill the pinch. And I think in the instance of even oil and gas, there was a contention even among their own industry. I mean, they had groups that were opposing each other even inside the industry. So there was no clear, just concerted effort that was universally energy versus the legislature and what they wanted or didn't want. So and next year will be more of the same. I mean, it is part of the process when we're an energy producing state.
I do want to talk about the process of the budget. Again, these bills came out late at midnight, 45 minutes before midnight. So they had to get these passed before midnight. We always talk about not any transparency, but this year there were no press releases. There was no announcement. I've never seen a budget situation like that. Usually there is some kind of major announcement. They have a thing going on.
There's a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Lawmakers are at least given a spreadsheet, not this year, until the day after they'd voted on it. They didn't receive a spreadsheet that told them about cuts to particular state agencies or increases
and
where
yet,
it meant
and during
until the
that
day
whole
after.
Process, I mean, there was discussion on where the cuts were going to be, all of them moving in that, whether it was held basically harmless or up to the 5%. I mean, there were no exaggerated cuts beyond that. So I think most lawmakers that were paying attention wanted to know in any particular area, core services or even some of the smaller agencies that have had cuts the last 6 years. So it's not a surprise to them that they were in this place as well. But I don't think it was so much a surprise in the transparency. I think it was a fact that as these members had to go to their respective caucuses, I mean, it was a constant shifting all across the board on where could you get the magic number of votes that you were looking for from the leadership standpoint. So I think there clearly was an effort in this past week to make certain that they could try to avoid a special session at least right now. And whether, Ryan, your point of do they have to come back or does something change down the road, that remains to be seen.
Well, the governor's going to say, and the governor says she's going to support it too. So
well, and so the governor had been talking tough about vetoing a budget. She seems to be walking back from that right now because there seems to be this deal. It may be the best that they can get, or at least maybe that's what she feels. I would encourage the governor, veto this budget. Bring them back into special session. Let's not let agencies, let's not let school district, rural hospitals, the Department of Transportation, let's not let them wait until November of 2017 to have their revenue undone by litigation and then have to come into a special session in November or December and then only to go back into regular session in February of 2018. What we're looking at here is a real systematic failure of our democratic institutions to be responsive to the needs of the people of Oklahoma. And I think that it's time that we start to think about not just reforming the budget process, but reforming our entire legislative process. Are we really better off with a Senate and a House? You know, should we look at a unicameral system? The 50% plus one, you know, single member majority districts, should we look at proportional representation? I think that we have to start thinking, are institutions responsive to the people of Oklahoma? I think the clear answer from this session and the previous sessions and what's probably coming ahead of us in 2018 is absolutely not. And so it doesn't matter who gets elected to governor, it doesn't matter who gets elected to the legislature if the systems that they operate in are inherently broken. And I think that that's kind of where we're at right now.
But if we're going to have this representative form of government where we have folks elected, they come to the Capitol, they are always going to have all of these pressures of outside, you know, interest groups, lobbyists, everyone in the mix, I mean, at every level. And I think when you look at the bottom line, we would, some of this rhetoric out there suggests that somehow we didn't have any money and we've got a budget that is, you know, horribly less than it was last year. The fact is we have an almost 1% increase in the budget that's being appropriated for FY18 over FY17. So I think when we look at it, it's not that we're having some retrenchment in government's, you know, government monies that are being utilized in the budget. It's the fact that there's this constant debate over where those monies should go and who gets more and who gets less.
The crisis, though, just keeps perpetuating year after year. I mean, we've watched, I mean, Department of Corrections, for example, I mean, they saw, you know, their budget hold harmless, I think maybe even like a point per something percentage increase in DOC. But when you've got 60% staffing ratios, when you've got continued growth in prison beds that are being occupied, I mean, that's something else. The governor right now, we're looking at some of her criminal justice bills just this morning, taping on Thursday morning, getting some movement. But if all of her criminal justice task force bills don't end up on her desk with a signature and they capitulate to the district attorneys and not hear those bills or fail them, what that does is it sets us up for a decade of insolvency, further insolvency in the Department of Corrections. There cannot be a responsible budget that is not accompanied with criminal justice reform measures. If those aren't there, I think the governor should veto it.
The legislative session ends Friday at 5. Leaders promised only two things this year, real ID compliance and teacher pay raises. They got one of those. Teacher pay raises never managed to come to fruition. Ryan, many people voted down State Question 779 last November, expecting lawmakers to take care of increasing teacher pay. Do you think any of those voters now have buyer's remorse?
You know, I'm sure that they do. You know, I think that, you know, maybe the folks that put together 779 have some remorse in the way they put it together. I mean, we can armchair quarterback that deal all day long. The real problem that we're dealing with right now that we're facing is that we've got politicians that are responsive to this increased power from the education lobby. Because if any 779 failing was a real letdown for the education community and their allies, but it also gave them this really powerful opportunity to organize, and that they have done. And they've maintained that momentum, and they've taken it into this legislative session. They've been very active, very vocal, and legislators aren't confused that teachers need this pay raise. They just don't have the money to give it to them. And so what we've seen are a number of gimmicks where legislators get to go on the record of having supported a teacher pay raise. And so in their mail pieces, come 2018, they're going to get to say, I voted for a teacher pay raise. They knew full well they couldn't afford it, but now they get to say that they've done it. And so I think that they're banking on teachers not being able to tell the difference. You know, the legislators can say what they want about teachers, but they're smart folks. They're going to see through this.
House Speaker Charles McCall said there was a House GA bill that had teacher pay raises. They also voted on the Senate one that didn't have pay raises. How much should the speaker, maybe if he really wanted the pay raises, just stick to his gun and say, no, we're going to do the House bill?
Well, apparently, I mean, there was absolutely no traction in the Senate for the teacher pay raise. I mean, it wasn't going anywhere on the Senate side. So while I think House Republicans worked long and hard, I mean, and they came into the session, as you say, with that as their mantra. But I think looking forward, I think there is some expectation that their 1-2-3 plan could very well, if things move the direction that everyone optimistically would like to see from a budget forecasting standpoint, that they could actually see that take place early in the next session. And I think, you know, in an election year, coming back, having heard from their constituents and the folks back home all summer, I mean, it is, I think, very likely that this is going to be a front burner issue, just like we saw this year, maybe with some different result.
Do Do you think the people that passed, maybe not with President Boren, but maybe with other people coming together, maybe putting together a new package, maybe for the November 2018 ballot?
You know, I think that that's for always, I've been part of coalitions that have tried to bypass and have successfully bypassed the legislature to get them, to get laws in place that we didn't think the legislature either had the guts or the wherewithal to get done on their own. We've seen that in criminal justice reform. They tried it with education. The problem is that it's prohibitively expensive. I mean, you're talking about millions of dollars in these campaigns to get this done. And, you know, while the oil and gas community can spend millions of dollars to go to the legislature to lobby to protect hundreds of millions of dollars in tax cuts, the education community and their allies simply just don't have the money to show up and keep, you know, putting these questions in front of the voters. Not to mention the fact that every time they do this, their opponents, largely again from the oil and gas community, throw in hundreds of thousands of dollars to defeat those proposals at the ballot box. So these become very expensive campaigns, and you know, one can hope that people will say, listen, we've got to get something done. We're going to go around the legislature. But how long can they afford that? I don't know.
There was a lot of talk about jobs with, as far as with the oil and gas industry. If we can raise the taxes, that we lose jobs. We do know for a fact that we are losing teachers left and right. I've got a dear friend of mine that's going to Texas. She's been teaching in Edmond for 20 years. And she can't do this. How much should people start being concerned about losing teacher jobs?
Well, I think this is the ongoing debate and ongoing discussion. I think, but let's remember the backdrop on the education budget this year. I mean, we are basically at a $2.4 billion budget with some change, which is equal to what it was last year. I mean, the broader mix of the debate and dialogue, I think, on education is not just teacher pay, but are we willing to bring everyone to the table and talk about things that need to happen in restructuring education and putting more pressure, I think, back into these districts and school boards to make, you know, to make themselves more accountable to the folks that actually have those kids in those respective schools where teachers can, teachers can see some real results, but they need to see it at the local level, not just assume that this is going to be some legislative fix someday down the road.
The Oklahoma Democratic Party elects possibly its youngest chair ever. 24-year-old Anna Langthorne is taking the reins of the party for the next 2 years. Ryan, first off, were you surprised by this election?
Well, I think everybody was a little surprised. I mean, you walked in with one of the most hotly contested chair races in recent memory. You had a few very strong candidates. Some candidates got in, some candidates got out. I've been a strong supporter from the very beginning of Mark Henriksen and his bid to become state party chair. And you had, you know, some real powerhouses at the table and a lot of internal dynamics within the state Democratic Party right now that are reflective of a party that is energized and is ready to do something to change the way the state of Oklahoma is governed. And so everybody was a little surprised, but again, I think that with that many candidates and you know that kind of energy, high turnouts from the precinct meetings all the way to the state convention, and you know multiple ballots, and so we've ended up with the state's youngest Democratic Party chair, and one of the youngest in the nation, maybe the youngest in the nation. I think Anna is well suited to do the job. She's familiar with campaigns and candidates, and knows the landscape in Oklahoma, understands the legislature, and you know from what I've heard, it's already begun reaching out to the folks that were defeated for the chair race and are you know working to bring the party together. I mean, there's a lot of energy. You know what we saw was, especially with Mark Henriksen, what represented kind of the Bernie wing of the party. Bernie Sanders, of course, won the Democratic primary in the state of Oklahoma. Yet party establishment in Oklahoma, much like party establishments everywhere, you know, tend to favor Hillary Clinton and the more establishment-oriented candidates. And so that's being reconciled within the party right now. I feel, you know, that by the time we hit 2018, if the Democratic Party can stop, you know, just surrendering issues to the Republican Party on everything from reproductive rights to health care, that they're going to be in a strong position.
And even when the Republican Party went young with Matt Pinnell, it really boosted the Republican Party from 2010 on, I mean, with the elections. So how important is it just to have someone sometimes a little bit younger and with some new ideas into a party?
Well, and I think, you know, looking at her resume, it's not so much just that she's young and brings the youth and enthusiasm, but she's someone who had been active with the Young Democrats, certainly understands the importance of the ground game, you know, building momentum, building grassroots, grassroots, building consensus. So, you know, I think it brings kind of a new, you know, a new freshness. Anytime party organizations have that type of leadership, it gives them an opportunity to energize their base in a new way. And I think, you know, certainly a lot of these young Democrat operatives have proven, I mean, with their success in some special elections as well as just regular elections in the last few years, I mean, that they do sense that there are some opportunities there. And I think it puts it certainly, you know, is a wake-up call to some Republicans, and I think just an ongoing realization for a lot of folks that have worked on the Republican side in campaigns and just in party organization, that you can't just assume that it's a given that the Democrats are kind of down on their back and never going to be competitive or never going to work hard to try to achieve some sort of a majority again. So, I mean, I think, you know, I think it is an interesting setup for 2018 with all of the races, you know, basically from the governor's chair on down to be in play. I think it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out.
One of the interesting concerns, I think, among progressives was, were we going to see this fatigue after the Trump inauguration, you know, the first 100 days? You know, it just seems like one crisis, one scandal, one thing after the other. And there's this worry that Democrats, progressives, are just going to get so worn out that they're going to disengage. Well, this party convention, I think, is evidence to the contrary, because what you saw was a spirited race for leadership positions. This is internal politics at its finest. And, you know, folks were showing up. This wasn't phoned in. This wasn't won by people who didn't show up. This is won by people who got up and they stayed there, and they were there late into the night to make sure that their candidate won.
I think the interesting question from a political perspective on the races in the future is, from the Democrat standpoint, if they move too far to the left, I mean, then is that going to be a palatable position to most Oklahomans who self-identify still as conservative? I mean, even among Democrat ranks, I mean, you still have older Democrats, many of whom who still consider themselves to be conservative in their philosophy. So to have some shift that is too far and too extreme and too quick, I think could potentially be a problem in some of these upcoming elections.
The generic label of conservative, I think you're right, a lot of Oklahomans still cling to that. What I would say is that when you drill down there, what you begin to find is that they're just applying a conservative label to, you know, progressive principles and ideas. I mean, it's similar to the poll that we saw not that long ago, where conservatives were brought in to talk about, in a focus group, to talk about the Affordable Care Act, and what the pollsters and the focus group folks that were conducting that found was that these people didn't like the Affordable Care Act, not because they didn't like Obama, but because they preferred a single payer system. And so these were conservatives that wanted something even bigger and better than the Affordable Care Act. And I think that that's the same in Oklahoma. And so if Democrats can drill down into that and say,
find that niche,
and, you know, do you want government making these important decisions about you and your life, or do you want to be able to make those decisions on your own? Do you want government to invest in infrastructure and healthcare and education? You know, you've got to drill down. I mean, if it's just a conservative versus a liberal or a Democrat versus Republican race, and you don't do more than that and start that conversation, you know, Democrats are in trouble.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.